Bobbish.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here at BobCon to give another talk. So I've been programming Haskell for a long time. Now I get paid for it. And I'm also a mathematician. So I tend to approach Haskell as a mathematician would. So I see these abstract data types and mathematical structures like monoids. And I really appreciate how Haskell can express them in code. And if I just choose the right structures and put them together, then I get the program that I want. But now I get paid to work in Haskell. And in the commercial world, there seems to be this dichotomy of, mathematics and academia on one side, and then the other side, there's code that is supposed to be practical, that works in production. I believe that this dichotomy is false. I believe that the code that is pleasing from a mathematical point of view is also the code that you want to run in production. And today, I would like to make this point by presenting to you an example. So I'm part of a team that writes a wallet software for blockchain called Cardano. Some users use it to transfer millions of dollars. And so this thing is definitely in production. But it's also a bit unwieldy. It's a large code base. It's a bit unwieldy, and by using some ideas from mathematics, we have been able, or are in the process of restructuring it so that it becomes much easier to maintain, and perhaps then introduce new features. And specifically, I'm going to talk about data encodings and how they allowed us to separate something I would call business logic from database operations. All right, I'm going to present to you code in the wild and how we changed it. Okay, so here, this is our code in the wild. This is a friendly way of calling it. This is a monolith. So everything is a total max. And what we actually want is this much cleaner picture, where we have a clear separation of concerns. So the thing on the right is mostly concerned about being white, and the thing on the left is mostly concerned about being red. Internally, they can still be a mess. But the point is that the communication between them, it's very clear and delineated, and that is something we managed to do here. So that is that was the generic talk. Every talk could begin about programming could begin like this. Now we come into the specifics about specific concerns that we can separate. So here is a concern. Let's call it business logic. Let's keep it very simple. So I have a data type, a set of things, set of T's, and I have two operations on them. One is I list all the things in that set, so it takes this data type and returns a list of things that are in it, and then I also consider a second operation, let's call it filter, which takes the set of things and removes some of them according to some criterion, which I will talk about later. So just extremely simple. And the other concern we have is operations on a database. So this would be about tables and rows inside the tables, and it has columns. And one way to model this is the following interface, for example. So we can load a set from the database. And here this is no longer a pure function, this is an IO action. And the other operation would be write. So we take a set and we write it, set of things, and we somehow map it to a database table. And a good signature for that would be, we take a set and return an IO action that simply does that. And the problem, this works. This is a good separation of concerns. If you can do that, do this. And the problem is that if the set of things becomes very large, then writing the entirety of the set to the database is very slow, because you have to write everything. And so in some cases, and our software was one of them, we want to update the database. So we have one row in the database that we want to update. But if we see this database as a set of things, then this write thing is not enough. So we need some kind of update operation. And this is essentially the pivoting point of what I want to talk about today. And this is where the data encodings come in. Okay, so before I tell you about the typing and signature of the update, what this is supposed to be, let me tell you a little bit more about what I want to do specifically. So this is about submitting transactions to a blockchain. So a blockchain is a chain of blocks. It stores information about who owns what kind of stuff, typically money, made up magic internet money. And if you want to transfer money from one owner to another owner, you have to send a transaction to the network, which stores stores and processes this blockchain, and some of the transactions may go into a block, and then they become a new source of truth for who owns which kind of magic internet money. And it may also happen that some transactions just don't make it. They are forgotten about. It's not very common, but you need to keep track of this corner case. So it can happen that a transaction expires. So this is the business logic in this case is about keeping track of transactions, some of which have expired. So it seems very, very simple. And this would be the interface. So we have a set of transactions, TX. We have two functions listing all the transactions that are currently in submission and expire. Remove all those that have expired. Our monolith is called Cardano Wallet. It's open source. On GitHub, it has 350 Haskell files, 150,000 lines of code. Of those, a third are test cases. And here's one example of this is code that was in master and in master branch at one point in time. So this mixes all those concerns. It's hard to understand as a whole, so let me focus on a few particular things. So it lists something. It's an IO action. It calls SQL more or less directly, and this is a SQL select operation from a database. So this is mixing these concerns very, very heavily. So you kind of the business logic of, oh, I have these transactions and I want to list them, is very much intermingled with the database where they're stored. And same thing for expired. So this is the original definition of expired. There was a master at some point. And the highlights are it's still an IO action. It's not a raw SQL statement. Now it uses something, a function called update where from a library called persist. So there's some weirdness as far as the level of abstraction goes. So this is now not SQL, okay? And it takes all the things that have expired and updates them. But there's a good reason why the code probably evolved in this way. So this was before my time. And the reason is that if we had load and write, then this would not be enough to write this particular function, because it somehow relies on this notion of update. I have a set of transactions, and I want to update just a few of them. And updating all of them at once on the database would be expensive. So we need something a little more, which allows us to separate these concerns better. And the point is, in order to have this update where it's not enough to change the database, we need some support from the business logic. So this function expire takes the original set, and instead of returning the new set of transactions, it needs to return some sort of description of what changed from the new set to the old set. So this, and this is where these data encodings come in. So the expire function now doesn't return a set, but a change or a difference, a delta from one set to the other. And then updates can take this change and apply it to the database. So that's one of the key points we have. We don't have to make the business of do I/O and the business logic itself, but we do need some support from it. All right, and this support comes in the form of what I like to call data encodings. And I would like to give you a brief introduction to them, or how I see it. Okay, so let's take a type of set of A's. The A's here are in red. And I want to define a type called data set 1. It's a disjoint union. It has two constructors. The one is I can either insert an element to a set, or I can delete an element from a set. And I can take this data and apply it to an actual set. In this case, it's very simple. I just call out to these functions that already exist, so I don't have to really implement this. I take the insert and the delete functions, and that's it. So in a sense, this data set 1 is a very small subset of all the functions that are available on sets. And I can put this pattern into a type class. So let's call this type class data. DA here is this, the instance would be this data set 1. It has its base. This is the type that the data is operated on. And then this apply function, which takes the data and turns it into an actual change. So this would be the one instance for this. We have.
Do you mean base of DA?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. Yes, so this should be base of DA. Right, A is not even in scope here. All right, so this would be the an implementation. The base type of this data is the type of sets, and we insert and delete stuff with this apply function. And the nice thing about structuring it in a type class such as this is we can define more data types using existing ones. For instance, here is a data set type that I actually want to use. It's a list of data set 1. So data set 1 took a single element and inserted it into the set or deleted it from the set. Here I take many elements, so it's a list of changes, and I apply them to the data. And this is also one key idea here is that both of these data types have the same base. They both operate on sets, but they're distinct data types. This stuff is not new. People often rediscover this, but they usually do it the other way around. They say, oh, I have a base type, and I have a single data type to that. I suggest to do it the other way around. And that is inspired by mathematics, actually. So there's a theory of vector bundles where this is the right way of doing it. But that would be that would be too far here. So here's one instance we can now write. Given a data type DA, we can the list of DAs is also something that we can apply. So the base type is exactly the same, and if we want to apply a list, we fold over this list of datas. We use a fold R here, and the reason is that we then get this law. If we have a list of datas, and YS is the end. Or the second part of the list, and XS is the head, near the head of the list, and the rear of the list is applied first, and the head of the list is applied last. So application goes from right to left here. This is the conventions naturally lead to this. If I want this equation to hold in this way with X is to the left and Y is to the right, then gendas are applied from right to left. Right, so and here's one example of how you would actually use this. So here's a definition of the expire function. Now we have a criterion, we have a certain time. We take the set of the X, and we want to delete all of this stuff which has expired. So we have a predicate here, a transaction X is expired. Well, if its expiry date is before now, and then we take the list of transactions and return a data for each element that we want to delete. So we return this delete Y is an element of delta set 1, and the whole list is the element of delta set, and that is the delta region. So how, this is how you would work this out in practice, and that is exactly what we did. I did promise a little bit of mathematics, which I'm going to squeeze in here. This type class and these delta types or delta encodings, they have this nice property that they form an interesting category. So the usual category of Haskell types and functions between them is, well, the types are the type, the objects, and the morphisms, those are functions between type. So morphism from A to B is as a function. But these delta types, the morphisms are more interesting. So a mapping between delta types means that we have a mapping from one base type to another base type. This would be this fairly ordinary function f here. But then you also have sort of a derivative that matches with this function. So this function, this derivative takes an element of the base type, it takes a delta, and computes a new delta that acts on the b's. And the idea is that this diagram on the left should commute. So if I apply a delta first, and I map with my function f to the blue stuff, then this should be the same if I first map from the red to the blue stuff, and from the blue stuff I use this computed delta for the blue stuff. So somehow it's about mapping deltas for red stuff to deltas for blue stuff. And that is an interesting category which I will not say much more about here. Alright, so this was about the delta encodings. Now for the other side, the database. So here's what we wanted to do. We had these two concerns, business logic, database operations. We talked about the need for deltas, and now how we deal with these database operations. So we have this set of three functions, load, write, and update, and now we package them up in a single data type. So we define a store as a facility for storing one value of type base delta. So the store is essentially just a record packaging up all those three things. The load operation, it returns a value of this base. The write operation takes a value from the base and puts it into the store. And update takes the delta and applies it directly to the store. And the store is parameterized by some monad and by this data type. And this packaging up in this way is very useful. So one example would be that delta is this delta set, and the base would be this set of transactions. And this thing has it captures two very useful ideas. One is that if you have something, make it a first class value. So now it's a store, and I can take, if I have different stores implemented in my code, I can combine them to get a store for a larger thing. And the second thing is that give it a type. So the store, it stores a single value. In this case, the value is a very complex thing. It's a set of stuff. But it's a single value. It has a type set of transactions. And we put it, and this is the thing that is being stored. So it stores a value. It doesn't store it in memory, because then we wouldn't need to use the store. So it stores it on disk, or some halfway in between, or something like that. But the important thing, it's an ordinary Haskell value, it has a type, and that's all this store thing does. And that was an extremely useful thing. And it's also extremely easy to test, for instance. So we have this store somewhere in the database, and we write something to the database, and we apply a change to the database, we apply another change to the database, and then we load from the database, and now the question is, was this all consistent, or is the state database still in a useful state? And the answer is, well, we can test it. We can take this pure value, and in there was a memory, and we can apply the first data to it, and then we can apply the second data, and then we simply check whether the store did the same thing. You see, the concern of the store was just storing the value in a different way. It was not about doing something else with the body. And yeah, that's a very, this is how we do most of the unit tests, actually. And then we also get choices. So we can say, okay, the red parts, they're clearly in memory implementations. And now they're the unit tests for the gray stuff, which we use in production. Or if we put, say, okay, in production, we actually want to be in memory, then the red stuff is the real implementation that goes into production, and the gray stuff, well, this is now the unit test. All right, so here's the current state of our mess. So we did this for right now, for submitted transactions, for funds that are in the wallet, for addresses, and the transaction history. And so for the submitted transactions, the funds and addresses, we now have a time. We have a Haskell time for that stuff. It's no longer opaque somewhere distributed in this database file. It now has a proper Haskell type. And so this parameter S, this is about the addresses, the checkpoints, they're about the funds, and the submissions thing, well, this is the thing that I try to explain with these transactions that are in the submission. And here is the type signature for one of our stores. So this is a store, it has a couple of type parameters. S is related to how we store addresses in the database file. And then the monad, well, it's a bit fancier than IO. And the last argument here, this is a data type for the wallet state itself, and here we compose it with a data type for maps, for data.map. And this runs in production. And the second thing that we have something similar for the transaction history, there it's a little bit more complicated, I can't show any code, but I can show what kind of trade-offs we can do. So we can say with a single line change, we can say, oh, we want to have the transaction history in memory, and then listing all transactions is fast, but takes a lot of memory. Or we can say, no, let's do the other thing instead and move them all to disk, and then listing all of them takes a lot more time, but it also uses 1 gigabyte less of memory. All right, so this is what I wanted to demonstrate today. The separation of concerns here, for our example, business logic and database operation. And ideas that we needed on the business logic side were was that it needs to have some support for efficient updates. And we can use this type class data, and these data encodings to model them. And one idea with that type class is that it's useful to have to have many deltas for a single base type. So if you try to do that, do it this way. And the other one is on the database side, we have this idea of a store that stores a single Haskell value of a single type. Questions? Yes?
This very much reminds me of what I heard earlier next door. When the talk was about differentiable functions. There you had a pure function that also knew how to compute its derivative. And here you have a pure function that mutates pure data, but you also keep track of how to mutate the data in the database.
Yes.
So I think there's a pattern here, but I don't know whether you want to see it that way.
You mean this pattern?
Yeah, so essentially what you're doing is you're having a functor, right? So you have a functor from storable Haskell values and functions to database states and database operations.
Yeah, but so first, it's true. there's some truth to it. The details are different. One remark is that this stuff is no longer concerned with databases. So we do apply these datas, we can apply them to databases, but when discussing datas, databases have no longer any relevance. That is one of the key points. And the second key point is that There's a thing called automatic differentiation, which you probably heard in the other time, is that indeed then you have a function between real numbers and you want to keep track of its derivatives as well. And there a similar pattern does show up. This is slightly, not sure if it helps, but for physicists, I would say, okay, so this one of them, the automatic differentiation, is about the tangent bundle, and this stuff is slightly more general in that you could say it's about vector bundles. And here is the idea that there is no unique notion of what is the derivative of a function. It depends on the data, on this type of data you can have. So there are many options for what a difference or differentiation means in this case.
So when you work with blockchain, you probably have distributed systems at some point. And did you ever come across CRDTs, or conflict-free replicated data types? Is that similar, or how does it relate?
What was the name of the data type, CRDT?
CRDT, conflict-free replicated data types.
Oh no, I didn't come across them. One thing that you can say is that, in one way, one way you can think is that each block of the blockchain, so you have a set of funds, a block in the blockchain will change the ownership of the funds, so you can map each block that is coming into, or that you receive from the blockchain to a set of changes. And sometimes you have to roll back, so you can't go forward all the way, you have to go back a bit, and then this would be equivalent to undoing this set of change. But maybe let's talk about it after that.
Are there more questions?
You mentioned a mathematical theory this is related to, vector bundles?
Yes, well it's more than a...
Could you briefly elaborate on what that is and all those?
Yeah, that is a good. Let me see if the. I think it's got me there. Yeah, so the first, from the theory of vector bundles. The first notion is probably the notion of a tangent bundle. So imagine you're driving a car, and you're at a certain point in your plane where you're driving, and you have a velocity. And the notion of a tangent bundle is this idea of you have an arbitrarily curved surface, and giving an answer to what is your velocity at any point. You see, if you are on a map, you can take your present position, you're slightly in the future position, and take the difference of that because you have these coordinates. But if you imagine, say, the sphere, the entirety of the Earth, then it's not, you can't take points on the Earth and subtract them. It's more difficult. And this is where the notion of a tangent bundle comes in. And the notion of a vector bundle is a generalization of that. So, for example, on the sphere, you have this. On the sphere, you can think of to each point of the sphere, you have a collection of vectors glued to it or attached to it. This is, and the whole thing is this bundle of tangent vectors. So you can think of the tangent plane of a sphere, and all the vectors that live in there. And the whole thing would be the tangent bundle. And then there's also something called the normal bundle, which is at each point of the sphere, you take the vector in three-dimensional space now, which points directly outward from the sphere. And that would also be a bundle of vectors. In both cases, somehow this tangent bundle, if you think of the sphere as your base type, and these vectors of changes that you make to volumes on the sphere, then depending on what kind of changes you have, you use one vector bundle or the other vector bundle. And in both cases, somehow there is a natural map from point that the vector attached to it to just the points. So if you take this collect this field and the tangent planes to it and forget about all the tangent planes, then you get this field. And this is very much similar to this type family.
It's how you embed a type into the type of its endomorphisms.
Not its endomorphisms, but the endomorphisms of another type, in this case the base type. Yes, there was another question.
Well, in this case, there's no geometry involved, right? So any bubble structure should be
found. So in this case, there's no geometry involved, right? So we are,
yes, no.
We are just taking inspiration. So in this case, these are essential trivial boundless structures. They're just going to be a direct product, and the hydrogens are just going to be universal projection, right? So how far can we push this analogy? Is it useful beyond the point? Do you have any non-trivial boundless structure subspins for this?
No, I don't. I don't think this analogy can be pushed too far. I think it can be pushed far enough to make this idea plausible. You take one base type and many data types on it. This is what I may have taken this too far by mentioning vector bundles. If there are any questions, not about vector bundles.
So the data sets, they go from one value, and I guess there's sometimes you have an element of a data set, like delete x, that doesn't make sense for a value. Maybe the value doesn't have x. And did that at one point bother you? Did you try to make it type safe so that it's, you have basically, I guess, a different type at each point? And did you experiment with that, like as a dependently typed programming language where you could actually express that? And is dependently programming the same as vector bundles?
I didn't say no questions about vector bundles. I have to admit that on the train from Leipzig to Germany, from Leipzig to Berlin, I was now reading about homotopy type theory, because precisely to answer this question. If you want to be really precise, then you may want to use dependently typed languages in the sense that you have a delta and it applies to a given value. So somehow in the type of the delta, you want to make sure that it's a single value that you apply to. In the case of Haskell, it's always a matter of practicality versus type safety versus usability. In this case, I'm not actually entirely sure myself, but this served for the moment that we don't use dependent types. If a delta doesn't apply to this value for some reason, then this function here is the identity function. So another design choice might have been to take the base type and return a maybe base type. If the delta, say we have a set and we delete something which is not actually in the set, then it would be fair to return nothing here. But in order to, for instance, for these unit tests, it's a bit more convenient to always get a value of the type out there. But you're right, this is there's some design space there which I didn't begin to explore yet.
So about the vector bundle, something completely different. No, I still remember when I learned Haskell, like, I don't know, 2011 or so, in real world Haskell, there was a chapter on map, just data.map. And it mentioned there is a up-and-coming library called Delta Map or something like that, but it doesn't perform well, and therefore it's, you know, a future thing that people are still working on. So the idea basically was, you know, basically what you just discussed. And now you're telling us that this is running in production, and I'm wondering, were there any breakthroughs, or how did that change from basically this real-world Haskell comment about, you know, this is just not feasible?
I don't know. It depends. I suppose it depends on what you want to use it for. I mean, it's running in production. therefore, it must be good. I don't know what the comment was about. Perhaps some even more efficient implementation. So, defining the data types by hand worked for us. That's
Continuing from the question that Joachim asked, so maybe instead of dependent types, you could have some guarantees. Like if we continue with this delete example, you could have a delete operation that deletes an element from a non-empty set, and then after that, the set may be empty. So you're not having base A to base A, but something different, and then this delta starts looking like a category.
Yes, that would be one point in the design space.
Okay, so about these vector bundles, no. something completely different. So in the beginning there was this idea of separation of concerns. So all this was like, okay, let's take all this database stuff and take it off to business logic. And I mean, in practice, it's often more like, okay, let's, we have this business logic and now we start a transaction and now we do all this crazy database stuff. And when the transaction is through, all our business logic stuff is also happening. So my question would be, if you separate all this business logic stuff, which has to happen in memory, so you have like one state of your system and you apply all this business logic stuff and then you get all your data sets, and then at some point you have to apply them to your database, how do you handle like split brain issues where like your state of your system in memory doesn't no longer match the actual database state?
So this is a problem that in Haskell does not appear, since it's a purely functional programming language. In memory, I have the old state and I have the new state, and I can choose which one to use at any point in time. And the points in time, they are mostly observed by this I/O monad. So when I call an I/O action and I want the state, whether it's the new or the old one, I can choose at that point. So typically what happens is that we call this update function, and after that we look at the very at the mutable variable that holds the state. And so there's an idea which I didn't talk about in this talk. I called it dbVar. It's like an mvar or a mutable variable. If you put something into it, it will automatically be written to disk. And there's an implementation for that, and this would take care of this concurrency question, for example.
I'm wondering how these delta encodings map to database operations in the end. Because, so SQL initially is a declarative programming language, and you're converting that to an imperative operation, which hypothetically sort of increases the number of operations substantially and, you know, discards what the database engine might do. Instead, sort of, you know, it will try to optimize the query somehow. You're sort of throwing that away. And sort of as a second part of that question, like how does the mapping happen, have you measured the performance impact of doing this compared to using SQL?
Okay, perhaps on the second part, I'm happy if the code looks somewhat manageable. On the first part, so it's more about the structure of the code than of the performance. On the first question, one way to rephrase it is to say that so SQL does offer a couple of verbs for changing database. Those verbs are inserting a row, or deleting a row, or updating a row. And if I come with my own data types, then the intention of these data encodings is that these are for more complicated. These are for compound types, which exist in Haskell, but which have no direct representation as database tables. You see, if I'm using SQL, I'm confined to the data types that SQL gives me. Those are tables. And so if I can express something as an insertion or deletion of rows, then certainly that helps me. But as we progress in abstraction, at some point, We have things like this wallet state here. There is no obvious mapping of this thing to a collection of database tables. And so the purpose of these data types is, I have a couple of operations on the wallet state. I know what the data of the wallet state is, and then I have to map it into a sequence of operations that are insert and update. And then I can group them and I may get some performance benefits. But this is about mapping the types, so to speak.
Okay, are there more questions? Still have a little bit of time.
there's this fundamental topic of SQL maybe not representing the data that you want. This is a bit like ACID state, right? Like ACID state, if you're familiar, does the sort of write ahead log in a very specific way, right? So it's a function from your state to your state, but it might have some parameters. And so your delta encoding is just the name of that function plus the argument, right? So that's kind of a nice
thing
that you can use to view the system.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point of bringing up ACID state. So it's a Haskell library. Which is slightly related. The idea is that you have a state in memory and it gets checkpointed to disk periodically and then atomic, so ACID means atomic, consistent, forgot the other two way. Now, I've briefly looked, I have looked at the library. I think what it does at some point when checkpointing, it writes the entirety of the state. So one difference from this approach to ACID is ACID gives you most of the stuff for free, or you use template Haskell and you put in the type and it does all the things. And here you have a bit more flexibility on what delta you specifically want, and you also have a little bit of flexibility on how it operates. So ACID state checkpoints the entirety of the state at certain intervals. You can thin them out, then you will gain some performance, but it will, if the state is large, it's not able to just write small things. At least as far as I understood from the ad hoc documentation.
Okay, thank you.